Do you drink a lot of water?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't. I don't like water all that much. I know you're supposed to drink it. I'd probably be 6'4 if I drank it, but unless I'm outside working and I'm really thirsty, it's just really hard for me to drink water. But the doctor's like, you need to drink more water. It's like serious. So my wife's like, told you, you know. And so she drinks it all. She carries those jugs around like they do today, you know, like 10 gallons, whatever those things are. I'm like, serious, what is up with these people? And so I went out and invested in some quality drinking equipment and water, speaking of water. Since I don't like to drink straight water, I followed my wife's advice. She buys those boxes of flavored powders at Costco.
Yep.
You try these? Raspberry and all kinds of different flavors. So she's like, if you don't like them, then kind of spruce it up. So she puts in her cup, she'll put a whole packet in there. It's too much for me, so I'm just gone for the half of the packet. When you put it in there, what's supposed to happen? When you shake it up, it's supposed to dissolve, right? And it's supposed to impact the entire glass, right? So if you did that, which I've done at this, you know, the week making my little drink, just shaking it up. If you started drinking it and you got a little raspberry flavor and then a pocket of just straight water, you're like, ooh, whoa, like what's up with that? That can't happen, right? I mean, like if it did, you're like, we got some scientists at the church. I need to call them, figure out what happened to my glass of water. When I was mixing up that water to drink this week, I thought, you know, this is a spiritual experience. Because I've tried to tell you, everything in life, if you pay attention to it, it's like a metaphor of spirituality. I'm like, this absolutely is a metaphor of spiritual life. How so? Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. The purpose of the magic powder is to permeate the entire glass, right? So let's switch that over to your spiritual walk, okay? You weren't a Christian. You became convinced that Jesus was the Messiah. You became convinced you were a sinner who needed a Savior. You trusted Jesus as Savior. He then forgave you of your sin, gave you his holiness. So positionally before him, you're holy. Now, the problem is you have a practical walk that is challenging each day, is it not? Yeah, so it's never just a straight line from salvation to glory and you just constantly grow in holiness. Now, you have moments, right? When something happens, totally, you go off the deep end. You're like, I can't believe I just did that or said that or whatever. So your holiness kind of changes as you're obedient, not obedient. But what is the goal of your Christian walk? But to allow the holy position that you have to permeate your entire life. You see the relationship in the metaphor? You're so quiet today. Yeah. A question demands an auditory response. So when you think about it like that, you then have to ask yourself a question. Then how am I doing? Is my position in Christ that's high and holy, is it impacting my daily walk? Because when you study Colossians, Paul's really good on chapters 1 and 2, who's Jesus? Because the cult, Gnosticism, messed up on who Jesus is. And so they were teaching, well, he's just a lesser form of God, an angelic power that has some deity status, but he's not fully God. So Paul's like, that's heresy. Let me explain who Jesus is. And so that's chapter 1 and chapter 2. And so if you know Jesus as the God-man, the Savior, then when he gets to chapter 3, he says, I'm going to move from doctrine to practice. So I'm going to move from the teaching to how this teaching about who Jesus is should impact all of your life. And so when you get to chapter 3, verse 5, he begins to explain to you how your knowledge of Jesus and walk with Jesus should impact everything that you do, everything. And so there's a whole bunch of commands here. Now, you're not supposed to do this because how I was trained to speak at Dallas Seminary, the professor would have a heart attack with what I'm going to do right now. But since there's no professor here to stop me, I'm going for it, okay? What am I going to do? I'm going to mix metaphors. Whoa. Rhetorically, you are not supposed to do this. This is a no-no. Because it's like, if you start with a metaphor, stick with the metaphor. Don't change the metaphor. I'm going to change the metaphor. Why? I've got no other choice. I mean, it's just, I see best fit to do this. So how am I going to do that? I'm going to move from the drink analogy. Remember that one?
Yeah.
With the powder supposed to permeate the entire glass. We're going to switch from that to Paul's metaphor, spirituality. He didn't use the water flavor metaphor. He used the clothing metaphor. Remember, have you been here for the last couple of weeks? He used the clothing. So how he did it was, there's clothes you got to take off. And there's clothes you got to put on. There's sinful clothing you don't want to wear anymore. And then there's godly clothing. You definitely want to have that on. So it's the same kind of motif. Your relationship with Jesus, high holy position, should impact your practical walk. I use the flavored powder motif. Paul used the lofty clothing technique. And so today, what we're going to do is look at the motif that we've studied in this section so far, chapter 3 and chapter 4. It's the same motif we studied before. We have another chart. We'll review the chart again to see where we are. The chart just shows you where he's at in his argumentation, because he's arguing a point. Who is Jesus? And if that's who Jesus is, and you know him as Savior, it should impact you, cause and effect. So we have been moving through chapter 3, where Paul identifies the wrong clothing, tells you the motivation to change your clothing away from the wicked stuff, to identifying more wrong clothing. Now we're over on the whole right side, identifying the right kind of clothing in chapters 3, 12 through 17, and we're going to move beyond that today as we get to verses 20, 21, etc. Each one of these things telling you how to live. So last Sunday was Father's Day. We talked to fathers, right? Yeah. Hopefully you had a good Sunday. Everything was good. We had a great time. But before that, so we're going back 2 weeks ago, when I was preaching and Paul is looking at the clothing, he had a word, because he's telling you your walk with Jesus should impact your whole life. He says, let me tell you how it impacts wives with husbands. Do you remember the sermon? Yeah. Wives? Yes. Yeah. So what was his counsel to wives? Respect him. Follow him. Be obedient to him. He uses the word obedience. Be submissive unto him. Follow his leadership. And so that was what he told the ladies to, because there's submission within the Trinity. There should be submission within the marriage. He had two things to tell men, in case men were looking at their wives going, he's totally got you. This is great. And then Paul's like, no, I got two things to tell you. One's positive, one's a negative. Ooh. What do you tell the men? How should you love your wife? As Christ loved the church, which means you need to like sacrifice for her. What else did he tell you? Don't treat her harshly. Wow. Do you do that? Harshly, verbally to her? He said, don't do that. It's not a godly man. So he said, your position with Christ should impact your marriage relationship. But Paul, being Paul, he's going to take this and he's going to apply it to another level of clothing that relates to a whole other people group within a family unit called the children. Any children here today? Anybody like, you're not in college yet. Anybody? They're slowly putting their hands up. What's going on here, Mom? This is scary. I need to talk to you for a few minutes. So parents, you can kind of sit back and relax. I'm going to talk to your children for just a minute because Paul does. Because Paul says, as we identify the right clothing, I'm going to talk to Christian children. Christian children. So what's his command for them? Verse 20. Here's what he says. Children, be obedient to your parents when you feel like it. He didn't say that. Be obedient to your parents when they seem to be in a good mood. He didn't say that. What did he say? It's in English. Be obedient to your parents. Don't you love prepositional phrases? And how many things? All things? We'll come back and study that in just a minute. And then the word for in Greek, it's gar, G-A-R. For is going to tell you the reason why you should just do what the command said. What's the reason why you should obey your parents? He tells you why if you're a Christian child. It's well-pleasing to who? The Lord. So if you're a Christian child, I used to be a Christian child, what should be my goal as a child? To be my parents. Why? Because it makes Jesus, he smiles at you. He blesses you. So let's analyze this for children. Children have a spiritual responsibility before the Lord to obey what their parents have to say about life, because they are, contrary to what you might think, wiser than you, right? They know more stuff, right? Don't you as parents? You should be going, hallelujah, yes. Yes. So Paul's teaching here is built on a command, not a suggestion. So the command is composed of two words. And I've told you this again. I know I'm repeating myself. And I know that you know this, but we have to repeat because of what Paul does. He takes the word, the verb akouo, which means to hear. He could have used that here and said, children, you need to listen to your parents. Akouo. He didn't do that. He took a preposition, hupo, and wedded it to akouo. Hupakouo. What is this guy talking about? It's my first Sunday. The text that Paul used is Greek, right? So it matters what the Greek says. So hupakouo means it's highly intensive when you take a preposition and wed it to a verb. He could have just said, akouo, listen to your parents. He went, uh-uh, I'm going to wed a preposition to it. Every Greek person listening went, whoa. Because you can take the word really, R-E-A-L-L-Y, and put that into the translation. And if you read it that way, it would be children, be really obedient to your parents. Oh, that's a little different. Would you say that as you as a parent, as you're sitting there thinking, I am so glad my child's here to listen to this today. Stop and ask yourself, remember back when you were a child? Were you always obedient? Why are you so quiet? Do not lie. You're in church. Okay? Were you always obedient? I wasn't. I was not. Dobson's book, The Strong Willed Child. I should have been on the front cover, according to my parents. Because I was. You name it, I did it. They bought a new home. They were all excited. I went into the new home, got some crayons, and colored all the walls of the house. And I remember when I did it. How old was I? I was 9. 9! When you don't know better, right? I was like, man, this would be cool. So while they're off looking at the new house and it's all empty, I got my crayons from somewhere, cigar box, whatever. And I remember going down the hallway doing this. All the next hall, in the kitchen. I went everywhere. Then I remember my mom came out of whatever room she was in with my sisters like, oh, my Lord. I'm like, looks cool, huh? That changed my life. I never did that again. I was always doing stuff like that. My grandpa, he was a Choctaw Indian, a poor, sixth grade education. He was a paper boy for the Southern Pacific Railroad, which my grandpa, in the desert heat of Southern California, would go into rail cars and put paper in it for shipping produce and stuff. And when the other trains came in, he would tear the paper out. That's what my grandpa did for a living. He had no education, but he was a hardworking Indian man. They didn't have any money. So they saved up money. I don't know if it was green stamps. Remember those?
Yeah.
And they bought a coffee table. It took a zillion green stamps. And it was glass top, beautiful. My grandma was like, this is amazing. Until I came over. I had a Tonka truck. Remember when they were really metal?
Yes.
I took my Tonka truck, and instead of racing it around on the tabletop, I went, bam! Poof! Disintegrated my grandmother's new tabletop. That changed my life. My rest of my life, my grandma constantly reminded me of that atrocity committed in her living room. So anyway, I totally get what Paul's saying here. Children, be obedient to your parents. Yeah, if you're a Christian child, yeah, you have moments when you are and other moments when not so good. But what should you be doing as a Christian child? When your parents give you a directive, sounds Mosaic, thou shalt do whatever, what should you say? Are you a child? I'm talking to the children. Okay, thank you. Big child. Thank you. It's interesting on the front row up here. That's tuned in. If you're a child and your parents give you a directive, what should you say to them when they give you a directive? You should say, they're so quiet now. Yes, yes, mom. Yes, dad. Yes, sir. Right? Right? Okay, so today they tell you to clear off the table after dinner. Well, they sit and enjoy the evening. What should you say? Hey, I'm not picking up a plate unless you and dad pick up a plate. Don't do that. They say that, you should probably clear off the table. Take out the trash and bring the cans in before I get home from work. Your dad tells you that. What should happen? Dad, I'll take the cans out, but man, I'm going to be busy, you know. I've got some video games lined up, you know. I'll eventually get the cans. No, you shouldn't do that. If your parents tell you it's been 4 weeks, you need to make your bed before you go to school. Clean up your room. You should probably get on that, right? And say, yes, yes, sir. How about this one? Keep your arms and your elbows off the table while you're eating. Yeah, but I'm tired from football practice, man. I'm tired, you know, son. Trust me, I've been down this road. Sit up. Get your hands off the table. I mean, get with the program. Yes, sir. Don't stab your brother with a fork while you're eating. Because my sister would do that, little cute blonde. She didn't come clean until we were in probably our 40s. And I kept telling my parents, I mean, she's stabbing me. But she was so sneaky when she would do it, and right in the ribs. And then if I retaliated, then my dad retaliated. And I'm like, don't do that. Don't open the door for strangers if your parents aren't home. What did I hear as a child? Open the door for strangers. So I did, to a hobo one day who knocked on the door when my parents were gone. We called them hobos back then, remember? And he was standing there with whiskery and everything. I lived near a rail yard. He's like, hi, little boy. Are your parents here? No. I go, what do you want? He goes, I need a cup of sugar. Come on in. He did. I gave him a cup of sugar. He walked out and left. And then my grandma happened to call. I just wanted to see how things are going. That's great. Oh, we had a visitor. She's like, what do you mean you had a visitor? There was somebody knocking at the door. Who was it? I don't know. Just one of those hobos. Hobos. My grandparents came over. My parents came over. What did my parents tell me? Do not open the door. I was like, okay, there might be exceptions. Don't do that. Honey, please turn off your cell phone and have some tech downtime. How am I going to live? You'll make it. Yes, sir, I'll turn it off, etc. Eat all of your broccoli because it's from God, right? Okay, stuff like that. So I'm talking to the children. When your parents give you a directive, you should say to them, yes, I'll do that. Why should you obey your parents? Let me give you some ideas why. One, Paul says you should. He says obedience is well-pleasing to the Lord. So when you're obedient to your parents, God's face smiles on you. If God's face smiles on you, he's going to bless you. Two, you should obey your parents because it makes your parents happy. Happy parents. It's a secret. Happy parents is a happy life. Right? You know the other one for husbands?
Yes.
What's that one? It should be in the Bible.
Happy.
Happy what?
Happy wife.
Is a happy life. Yeah. Same thing for children. Happy parents, happy life. Another reason. Third, obey your parents shows you the way to love God. How so? John chapter 14, verse 23. Jesus said to the disciples, if anyone loves me, he will, do you know this text? Keep my word. So how do you know if you love Jesus? You obey what he says. How do you know if you really love your parents? Well, you do what they say. And if you can love your parents in that way, then you definitely can learn how to love God. Number four, obedience to parents builds trust. Trust, I'm going to tell you as a child or a teen, is like, it's like owning a gold mine. The more your parents trust you, the more stuff they'll let you do without supervision. Did you hear me? Why? Because they trust you with the car, right? They know that you're going to be trustworthy, so they will let you have the car. They might even be a little bit looser with curfew times and things like that. Why? Because they trust you. Fifth, obedience to parents translates into obedience to others. So what I always tell my children is, if you disrespect your mother, cuss her, yell at her, whatever it is, you disrespect your mother, which you're not going to do in the home, but if you do that, you're going to do that in public to a police officer, right? To a school teacher, to a coach, to a piano teacher. It goes on down the line. What's wrong with our culture? No respect for, like, police officers, federal agents, etc. Why? No school teachers. No respect. Why? Well, it starts in the home. Where does a child learn how to respond to somebody in authority? Mom and dad. So what do you have in our culture? You have young people taking over intersections. Whole mobs of them taking over intersections. All kinds of wild, crazy stuff happens. They take over beaches, fights, gunfire. It's amazing. Drunken parties. They take over, they swarm stores, mobs of them. And then they loot and steal and all run out. And they're on video. Hello? They're catching you running out. And I'll tell you, if my father would have caught me at any one of those things, as a federal agent, that'd been the last time I ever showed up at one of those things. What's missing is lack of parental authority in the home. Teaching the children the importance of knowing God and then walking with God and obeying and listening to parents, because the parents are not holding the children accountable. So he says here, be obedient to your parents. And he says, in all things, which leads to a question if you're a kid. I was a thinking kid. So did Paul mean everything? Like, are there exceptions? So, are there exceptions? Would you say there's exceptions?
Yeah.
So he's kind of speaking maybe hyperbolically, kind of setting the bar high. But yeah, Paul knows there's exceptions. Here's some exceptions if you're a child as to when you would not obey a parent. Number one, if a parent wants you to do something that is immoral, won't do that. Two, if they, as a parent, want you to do something that is contrary to your faith, they're not a Christian, but you are, and they want you to do something to defy your faith, you have to tell your dad or your mom or both of them, I can't do that as a Christian. Three, if they want you to do something in an area that's a gray moral area for you, and you can't do the gray moral area, then you can't listen to them because you can't do that. It would be sin unto you. Four, If they want you to do something that is potentially dangerous or deadly, but I can't do that either. If they want you to do something like keep a family secret secret that involves criminal activity within said family, can't do that either. I mean, just use your brain. When Paul's saying obey them, what's by and large, but if they're doing any one of those kinds of things, well, then you have every right as a Christian to stand on what God would say, not on what man would say. Leads to another question. This is for parents. Does that mean that if you're older now and you're out of the home and you're married and you got your own kids, that you have to obey everything that your mom and dad say to you now? How many are married? You're so quiet. Yeah. So how many have a mother-in-law? Yeah, you do, huh? Do they meddle? Is there mother-in-law mayhem in your family? It could happen, right? Is she sitting next to you? So don't say anything. Just, yeah. Yeah, talk to her, Marty. Tell her. Yeah, mother-in-law mayhem. So parents, you know, they all of a sudden their kid gets married, etc. They have kids, and the parents looking at how you and your husband are raising the children, and they're going, ain't going to work. They're talking among themselves. That's just not going to work. It's not going to be effective. Trying to reason with a five-year-old, that's impossible, etc. So you might have a mother or father step in and go, honey, just let me tell you how this works. This is how you do discipline. Do you have to listen to your mom or your dad? No. Well, you have to honor them, right? Now you have a new relationship. Now you're the parent. So you can listen to your parent. You can honor them and show dignity toward them, but you don't have to follow everything they had to say because now you're responsible for your own family. So like my mom, when I first had children, my mom, who saved me from prison with, according to her, by keeping me in a tight box, she told me one day, because she knew she couldn't give me a dictate on how to do things. So she came to me one day and she said, Marty, I just want to give you some advice, some wisdom and counsel on child rearing. And she said, it's the only thing I will ever say to you in your entire life. I'm like, okay. So what do I need to know as a man? She said, you just need to, whatever you and Liz decide is discipline, be consistent. Don't deviate. Because she said, your children will try to pit one against the other and divide both of you. Don't let them do that. Be united and be consistent. Because kids do try to divide you, don't they? Because one of you is a softie. Did you hear me? One of you is a softie. The other one is more like Moses. And I know this from my own life. Because if you were to ask my children, am I the softie or Moses? Like, who do you think I am? I'm Moses. Yeah. You ask me something? No. Dad, I didn't even get the whole thing. No. It's going to be no. You know? You don't need a third ear piercing. You don't need a tattoo. You don't. I mean, I can give you all the things, you know? Go to the mom. Hey, let's talk about it. Let's debate. Let's discuss. You know? So realizing the relationship is like that, I have developed, because they'll go to my wife first before they come to me. Even now as adults. So over the years, I've learned to develop, and this is free, this is extra, this is free. So to help us navigate, I've developed Marty 1 and Marty 2. Daddy 1, Daddy 2. Dad 2, Dad 1, Dad 2. So Dad 1, Moses. Dad 2, Gumby Flexible. Okay? So if they come to me, even my grandchildren know this, they'll come to me, hey, Papa 2. Yeah, that type of thing. So it can be helpful to you. I'm just saying, it's just extra for learning how to raise your children. So, yeah, you can give them advice, but you can't meddle in their lives. Let your children do what they want to do. Honor your parents. Take care of them. Love them until God calls them home. But you're responsible to raise those children. Finally, I would tell you that under child rearing, he's assuming that you have some kind of laws, rules, and regulations in your family, right? Otherwise, it would be total chaos, right? So I studied in grad school under Minrith and Meyer of the Minrith Meyer Clinics. So that's who trained me in counseling, some of the best psychiatrists in the United States. So they were amazing men. They're now both deceased. But they wrote a book many years ago called Child Rearing and Personality Development. Child Rearing, Personality Development. If you're a parent, you need to read that book. He will teach you how to raise a child, whether it's a five-year-old or a 15-year-old. They will explain to you from all of their studies of children that they've done in counseling all across the United States how to raise a great child. But in this book, they have a chart. It's really a graph. And since we're in D.C., we love graphs and charts, right? So what would church service be without grammar and a chart? So here's the chart. How many are parents? You are one of these quadrants up here. There's four quadrants. You're one of these. So there's four models of child rearing: authoritarian, authoritative, the indifferent parenting model, or the permissive parenting model. And in the middle line is showing you from high to low, high demand and control or low demand and control. Going across is responsiveness. You either get low results or high results. You're one of those. How do you know which one you are if you're a Christian parent? Well, let me explain them to you. Authoritarian model. What is authoritarian model concerned with? Total obedience with no questions. Can you ask your dad for explanation? Oh, no, you would never ask him a question. He would just say, you just need to do this because I said so. That kind of model raises a child who is not independent, because they're afraid to be, and they're not self-sufficient because they lean on you too much. The indifferent approach to child rearing has few demands on a child, and the parent doesn't care too much about the child's feelings and desires, and they're not very involved with their children, and they tend to raise children that are highly aggressive and demand a lot from other people. Third kind of parenting model, permissive parenting. Hey, whatever. This parent tries to be your best friend. They're trying to be your best friend. And so that whatever goes is good. Hey, if you feel it's good for you. They're permissive, that kind of parent. They tend to be friends with you. Discipline can kind of come and go. You never know, well, this was wrong yesterday, but today it's the what? They raise children that are typically hostile and withdrawn and highly dependent. Fourth kind of model. These are all from Minerith and Myers studies all across the United States. The authoritative parent, what are they like? Well, they're like Moses. They have laws, rules, and regulations, but they treat the child with dignity and respect, so there's more discussion and debate going on in that family. They explain rules to the child, and they also realize that the children are wired differently. So you have children, right? Are they the same? No. You know, I've had people tell me before, they'll come into my office, the marriage's falling apart, and they'll tell me something like this. You know, our marriage is really, you know, not doing very well, so we think that we'll just have a child to help build our marriage. What would you tell them? No. Let's talk. Children are wonderful. It's a whole nother level of wow. You got to get your marriage right. And so if you look at these different models, there are four to choose from, and I would submit to you that of those models, the best approach is the authoritative parent that actually listens to the child, because they're all wired differently. So I had two children, and they were both completely different. If you think you're gonna, if you get your first child and they're a piece of cake, they always do what you tell them to do. They clean their room. They're easy to talk to. They don't cause you any problems. They don't lie and all that kind of stuff. And you're thinking, honey, we should have another one just like this. Good luck, because you're not necessarily going to get that one for number two, right? So you have number two, and two is different. So I had both. I had two different kinds. So I had one that at 9 o'clock in the morning, I could discipline him for one thing, and at 9:15, he'd do the same thing over again. Hello? What happened between 9 and 9:15? You know, can't you put these two together that, hello, that's not what I want you to do. Now, my daughter, total opposite. She did something wrong. All I had to do was look at her. And she would implode on me. Tears, the whole thing. Dad, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Whoa, I didn't say anything. I could tell by your look. It's like Moses number one, daddy number one. Yeah, scary. Yeah, yeah. So you have this in your family? Yeah. Right. So what's the best model? Well, I think the best model is authoritarian model. You love your kid. You show dignity to the kid. You care about what they have to say. You want to raise a child that's independent, self-sufficient, and has good self-esteem. Pick that model. All right? But by and large, this is all about children learning how to obey a parent. Two, garment 15. He switches from children. He starts talking to fathers. Oh, you want to be a wise father? Let me tell you how to do it. What's he say in verse 21? Fathers. Oh. Well, let's just move on to lunch. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Why shouldn't I do that, Paul? Well, you can crush them as a man. You're scary. You're big. You're muscular. Notice this is addressed to fathers, because you can see the Greek word right here, pateros. That's the word for father. Why isn't he talking to moms? Well, because dads can be more... This is a problem for men. Now, the word father in Greek can also refer be translated men and women, but he's specifically speaking to a father here. He's telling the men who lead the family, are you exasperating your children? Now, what is it? This leads to a question, because a thinking man's going to want to know, well, exactly what does it mean to exasperate a child? I don't really know what that means, so I'm not guilty. Really? Okay, let me give you what the Greek word means. It means to vex or harass a child, or to provoke them to anger by your activity. Oh, well, I don't really know what you're talking about. Okay, let me explain to you what I'm talking about. How would you vex a child? I'll give you some ideas. You discipline for things they did not do. Okay? You discipline them too harshly when you discipline them. You belittle them and make fun of them, and you do it in front of their friends. Not good. That vexes them. You're physically mean and cruel, and they can't stop you because of your size. You pick at them constantly. So no matter how well they do in school or sports, there's always one more thing they need to improve on. You never say how great they were doing. You provoke them. You vex them. You withhold love and affection from them when they don't do things like you think they should do. You constantly find fault. You're always angry with them. You're never happy, always grumpy. Your rules are built on double standards. A child can spot a hypocrite a mile away. You come up with dictates and you don't follow the same rules in your life, the child's going to see the inconsistency and be provoked. You show favoritism of one child over the other. Your brother's away at college right now. He was such a superior athlete. I wish you could figure out how to dribble. This is ridiculous. You're uncoordinated, and on and on and on it goes. That child is provoked. You break promises more often than not to a child. You discuss their mistakes constantly. You want absolute obedience without ever explaining why, and constantly say, don't question me, just do it. You provoke them. You ignore them while you're watching a sporting event, maybe on TV, golf, whatever it is. And they come down, sit next to you, and they want to have a conversation about something. And you're like, serious? It's the first quarter. Wait till halftime. I tell you, if you park the TV off for a few seconds, because football games, 2-minute warning, it's 40 minutes, isn't it? I mean, just give it a rest. You're not going to miss much. Just park the TV and just talk to the child or the teen. Otherwise, you're going to provoke them. And you provoke them when you don't ever admit when you blow it, because you are as a parent, aren't you? You're going to blow it. And you win that child when you go to them and you tell them, son, I am so sorry. I absolutely blew it as your dad. And you will win their allegiance and not provoke them. Those are just some ideas. It's not exhaustive by any means. But Paul says the command for fathers, and then secondarily mothers, is don't live in such a way in the home that your child is constantly vexed by your parenting. And if you don't do that and you raise a child that you build up and instead of blast them all the time, you're going to raise a great young Christian woman or a young man that will do great things for God. I read this week that there's two ways to raise horses. First way is the slow way. You get to know the horse. You spend time with the horse. You brush the horse. You groom the horse. And one day you throw like a little blanket over the back of the horse. You do that a couple of times. Then you might use a bit and a bridle, and you slowly, incrementally work your way through a saddle. That's one way. Second way, you take a 2x4. You hit the horse's legs and let the horse know who's in total control. And from what I read this week of people that train horses, if you did the second way to a horse, you get instant obedience from that horse. They're scared to death of you, but that horse will never be the kind of horse it could be. We'll just apply that to child rearing. Some parents are like the second model when they should be the first model, the kinder, gentler, more compassionate model. Go that route and God will bless you greatly. Have a wonderful day. Now everybody knows what they need to be doing when they leave, right? Children, you're supposed to follow what your parents have to say. And fathers and mothers, well, don't exasperate them. Love on them. Care for them, because Christ does.